Hi, I'm your friend Claude.
And I am just Jamie.
And today we're talking pop culture crossovers. We're going to go through our personal selections of crossovers in entertainment and media that had already happened that we've enjoyed the most and ones that we would like to see in the future, sort of a dream list. Today on the Nerd Bomber Podcast.
So, you know, pop culture crossovers are not, it's not like a new thing. I mean, you see a lot of it online because people do fan fiction and fan art. And so they create what they would like to see. But it's not necessarily new. There's been a lot over the years. When we decided to do this topic, I said I was probably going to stay away from doing comic book character crossovers because comic books have done this a lot, obviously. I mean, individual comic companies have, like, fairly consistent universes, so obviously their characters cross over, but even like a character like Batman has crossed over with everybody. There's been Predator crossovers, Star Wars crossovers, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle crossovers, Hellboy crossovers with Batman. So, like I said, crossovers are not a new thing, but I think we each have our favorites, and I think I have some that haven't been done yet, although maybe I could be proven wrong, but I haven't seen it done.
Yes, I'm going to start us off with a trip back to the 90s, 1998 to be specific, which is a year frequently covered on this show. If you've heard our 3-2-1 pop episodes, September will be posted very soon. So in 1998, something happened on TV that had been kind of like almost like a fantasy fight in the minds of fans for a long time. And that is the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles coming face to face with the Power Rangers.
Oh, that's right. This was live-action TV, right?
Yep, yep.
Yeah.
At the time, the Turtles had a live-action TV show on Fox called The Next Mutation, infamous for its sudden introduction to the existing mythos of a fifth female Ninja Turtle named Venus, who was...
Right.
They actually, it turns out, they introduced... The producers of the show introduced this character without clearing it with the creators. And Peter Laird, I guess, hated the character so much that he insisted in all future forms that the Ninja Turtles take that they will not, they have to promise to not use this character.
Wow. All right.
Yeah, so that's why you've never seen or heard from her again. But yeah, it was, I think it was, I should have prepared more. I want to say it was Power Rangers in Space at the time.
I definitely wouldn't be able to tell you.
It was no longer Mighty Morphin Power Rangers, like at the peak of when this topic was always kind of talked about. That was what, you know, everybody kind of envisioned.
You know, it's weird. I know that this exists, but it's strange to me that there was a live action Ninja Turtle show ever on because I had zero awareness of it. And by 1998, we were 16. Maybe I'd left it behind me a little bit, but it's hard to believe that I had no idea whatsoever that it was that it existed.
Right. I mean, I used to watch an occasional episode here and there. I liked the idea of it. The execution left quite a lot to be desired. And honestly, this show was probably the first time I can remember, anyway, kind of the look of the Ninja Turtles being played around with. It's,
right.
It's a lot. It's actually kind of similar to what they've been doing a lot with the more modern incarnations, with the weird, like, their whole arms are wrapped in tape and, you know, like, the masks are now, like, whole head masks or whatever. And
right, maybe there's one person wearing kind of something that looks like samurai armor.
Right.
And one's got, like, a half of a shoulder pad on, things like that.
Yeah, there were some liberties taken.
What, now, maybe this is getting off a little bit off track, but the third Ninja Turtles movie is kind of maligned not only for the story but also for like the low quality of the costumes and the animatronic heads.
Right.
How does the show compare to that?
It's a different look, so there's like a distinction between them, but in terms of quality, it's probably comparable.
Yeah,
honestly.
Okay. I'm not surprised to hear that.
Yeah.
That's kind of what I was expecting you to say.
Right. But yeah, so basically what I'm getting at is neither the Power Rangers, the version of the Power Rangers on the air at the time, nor the version of the Ninja Turtles involved in this event were kind of the strongest, most recognizable versions that people, you know, originally kind of wanted to see meet up or go head-to-head.
Right.
But it did finally happen on this show, on this episode. I don't think it was a multi-parter. I think it was just a one-off. And it kind of has, it takes the form that most of these kind of crossover events take across all forms of media, TV, movies, comics, whatever it might be, where initially there's sort of a squaring off, a combat between the two, you know, main entities. They're, of course, they're both, you know, heroes, but suddenly they get some sort of misunderstanding and they have to, you know, always fight each other. Yeah.
Always.
But then they team up to stop a common enemy. And
yep.
Yeah. And this is no different, but it's notable because this is finally where it happened.
Yeah, that does follow a very similar pattern. You know, before we get, so is that your first, like, are you picking that one as one of your favorites that's been done, or just a significant one that you wanted to mention?
Yeah, no, that's my first pick for one of the ones that's been done, just because it's such a pop culture, they're two pop culture heavyweights.
Gotcha.
I'm not necessarily, like, stoked about how it came out or anything, but
right,
it was cool.
I mean, you know, there's been some obvious ones over the years, Predator and Boba Fett, RoboCop and Terminator, G.I. Joe and Transformers. But as you were talking and as I've been thinking, you know, we said we're going to do two each, but I've actually got three, so I'm going off script.
Oh, my God.
I know. But the first one is kind of, I don't know that I would pick it as one of my favorites, but it's so significant that I just think it deserves mention. That's the 1996 crossover between Marvel and DC.
Oh, definitely.
Now, I know I said I was also staying away from comic books, but that's just for my own picks. This is something that already happened, so I feel I feel okay about talking about it. You know, the Marvel versus DC thing, there's a mainline story that crosses the characters over. I have that. It's not great, and they try to squeeze a lot into it, and it's really tricky because you have these competing comic book companies squaring their characters off against each other. So all the fights that they have to be sort of carefully constructed to not seem like one is the,
right,
you know, the obvious victor, or that one is obviously better. You know, it's always like just a slight outmaneuvering, or like sort of a, you know, whatever it is, happenstance that happens, you know, one character wins over another, a technicality. But the reason it's so significant isn't so much just that basic crossover story. It's what came out of it, the Amalgam Universe.
Yep.
That is something that I think is pretty new. Also, you know, this whole thing, the whole way they structured it kind of goes away from the stereotypical storyline that you describe, where there's a misunderstanding and then they rise against a common enemy.
Yeah.
In this one, there's really no misunderstanding. All the characters understand fully what's happening.
Right.
They're forced to fight anyway. So that's kind of an interesting twist on it. And the other thing that separates it from what you were talking about is obviously this Amalgam Universe, which was a combined Marvel-DC universe that ran for the better part of a year, I want to say.
Yeah, at least a year.
So it had such characters as Darkclaw, which was a character, which was a combination of Wolverine and Batman. Right. And they had, I think, Super Soldier.
Yep.
Was a combination of Superman and Captain America. And there was there was a combination of Dr. Fate from DC. Was he combined with Dr. Strange or with Professor X?
I can't remember. Dr. Strange would have been the...
That's the obvious one. Choice. But I feel like there was a Professor X crossover in there somewhere, too.
Right.
Anyway, it was very unique that what they did with the result of this crossover was this Amalgam Universe. And I think that was very new and fresh. And I don't think anything like that's been done since.
Well, I think the scale of it, too, was something pretty new. A new twist on it.
Absolutely.
Like, we're not, you know, as we'll discuss perhaps further into the episode, one-off meetings between each company's characters had happened multiple times in the past prior to this.
Right.
But this is the first time where the entire company's roster is going up against the other entire company's roster. Obviously, the focus was on, you know, the big 8 to 10 characters from each side. But this is essentially the whole universe against the whole universe, and it was, I don't know that, I mean, it was a pretty ambitious undertaking.
I've got it. It was it was Dr. Strange Fate.
That's right, duh.
So it was Fate and, it was Dr. Fate and Dr. Strange, which is, like you said, the obvious way to do it.
Right. I didn't like a lot of those Amalgam mashups, it's embarrassing that I couldn't remember which one that was, because that was probably my second favorite one behind, obviously, Darkclaw.
Okay, so actually, I have to go back a little bit. This is the summary of the character, all right? Dr. Strange Fate is an amalgamation of DC Comics' Dr. Fate and Marvel Comics' Dr. Strange with the identity of Professor X.
Okay, so there was a Professor X element in there.
So that is an interesting sort of trio of personalities and characters, which is weird because Professor X doesn't really fit into that whole magic thing.
Right.
It's an interesting choice.
I mean, basically, if you take those three and smash them together, that's maybe the most powerful character you can even conjure up.
That's true. And actually, his was the character that became aware that their universe was wrong.
Right.
Because everybody else was psychologically, you know, that's all they... It worked in such a way where they didn't realize that they came from something else, but they were able to figure it out. Doctor Strange fate, I say they... Yeah. We're able to figure it out.
They like Venom is they.
It kind of, yeah, it's very interesting. Like I said, it's kind of unique.
Yeah, it looks like, I'm just seeing a picture of some of the other characters. I remember Wonder Woman and Storm were mashed up.
Yep.
I remember Superboy and Spider-Man for whatever reason. And it looks like Doctor Doom and Doomsday. And if they didn't call him Doctor Doomsday, they missed an opportunity.
No kidding. I think they did a lot. I think a lot of the amalgamations came from characters that end up fighting each other.
Right.
That's not always the case, though, because Wolverine and Batman didn't fight each other. They don't line up. Batman fought Captain America, actually. Wolverine fought Lobo.
Right.
Which is not a good mashup of powers, but just personalities.
Right, yeah.
Superman fought Hulk, and Captain America, like I said, fought Batman. It looks like... Oh... What's the Suicide Squad sniper character's name? I forget.
Deadshot.
Deadshot. Looks like Deadshot matched up with Bullseye.
Yep. Deadeye, hopefully.
I hope so. Yeah. Oh, man. There's a lot of... I'm looking at a picture here, but it doesn't have their names listed.
Right. Oh, here we go. Oh. I've got names, but I've got the secret identity names that they gave
me. Well, that's no good at all. Like
Dark Claw is Logan Wayne. I mean, come on.
So Ryan the Hunter...
Is that one of them?
Like Orion and Thor.
No shit.
Yeah. That's an interesting combination, too. Yeah. So anyway, a lot of interesting stuff here that I'd be interested to read the stories that they would come up with. Devil Bow is Green Arrow and Daredevil.
Yeah, that's pretty intriguing.
Yeah.
Is that Clinton Archer?
Well, I would hope so.
No, apparently they also mash up Green Arrow and Hawkeye.
Oh, yeah, that's interesting.
That's what I'm having. Clinton Archer is... They kept his name Hawkeye, though.
I've got one here that says Galactiac. It's Galactus and Brainiac.
Hmm. Interesting.
Yeah, we could probably keep going on this all
right,
day.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah, it was a very interesting event. And like you said, it wasn't just a one-off. I mean, they rode this out for a while.
Right.
Which is kind of, it's amazing they were able to cooperate so efficiently over that course of time.
I don't know, and again, I'm trying to look it up on the fly, but I don't think that the amalgam portion of the DC versus Marvel experiment was particularly financially successful. So it is kind of odd that they dedicated so much time to it.
Yeah, I mean, once you put the resources forth, maybe you got to ride it out, I guess. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, because, you know, the volume, the collected work of the crossover, the main storyline, is pretty thick. I mean, it seems like it's at least a year's worth of issues of comics.
Yeah.
So, I mean, yeah, that's a year commitment. And then the Amalgam Universe kind of pops up, too. So, I don't know.
Yeah, I guess it makes sense because you're, like I said, it's really the first time you're dealing with the entire resources of both companies.
Right.
So it's not anything to sneeze at. And that's probably why it's never happened since.
Probably. And isn't likely to, it would seem to me.
Right. Well, my next pick fits perfectly alongside this one in that it is one of the comic book issues that I mentioned previously where it's a one-off kind of instance of a DC and Marvel character meeting up, and this one in particular is the first one I ever owned or became aware of, and my favorite one to this day is from 1976, I believe, Superman versus Spider-Man. It was, I think, I don't know if it was called Giant Size, but it was a larger than regular size comic story, and it is what introduced me to the artist Ross Andrew, who did the whole issue, and it set the bar for me for comics art and what it could be, and it established my favorite looks, like versions of those characters, how they would appear in a comic. So it's probably my all-time favorite single comic book issue.
Yeah, I was going to say it's a single issue. Yeah. Maybe a giant size issue. We're not right. sure. But yeah, that's interesting. I've seen pieces of that. It's a strange... I guess it's not so strange. I mean, that combination of characters is interesting, I guess. Superman and Spider-Man do not match up very well in terms of their ability to have a conflict.
Yeah, and you see that play out. I mean, it's really just that each company's main marquee star.
At that basically. Time, yeah. It's there was a time where Spider-Man still is one of Marvel's key characters, but there was a time when he was the guy. Spider-Man was it.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's his... To this day, I think it's... On certain uses, anyway, it's his face is what Marvel uses almost as an alternate logo.
Right, yeah.
So, I mean, it's kind of... At least it's ingrained in a significant portion of pop culture. Spider-Man and Marvel are synonymous.
Yeah, I think there's only two characters that probably rival him within Marvel at this point. To say nothing of any classic character from the past that might have a rightful claim to it. Right. There's only a couple, and it's... You know, Captain America probably has a claim.
Yeah.
Wolverine, because mm-hmm. of his huge popularity in the 80s and 90s into the 2000s, thanks to the comics, the cartoon, and the movie.
Yep.
And then the other one is Iron Man.
Yeah.
Thanks only to the last 10 years of the MCU movies.
That's true.
Because before that, you know, it's hard to believe, or maybe it's sometimes forgotten or overlooked, that Marvel movies that with their films, they started the Marvel Cinematic Universe with a character in Iron Man that was not really a top-tier character in the comic books, never was.
I mean, he was certainly well-known, especially among fans, but yeah, he was not ever, like, on the short list of people's favorite Marvel characters.
No.
You know, obviously, he's probably on the short list of, like, names when you think of the Avengers, but if you're just going, who's your favorite Marvel superhero? I don't know if anybody was going Iron Man before 2008.
Right, probably not, except for a real super fan.
Right. But, yeah, so then to this day, Ross Andrew is my second favorite comic book artist of all time. But, yeah, Superman, Spider-Man. If you haven't seen it, it's worth your time to make it a point to find at least some of the artwork from it.
I guess maybe I should look into that a little bit more heavily. All right, so my next one is one that I only kind of saw recently. I guess I was aware that it existed before I actually picked it up. It's, again, comic books, but the characters are not super well known for their comic books. And that is it's a comic book crossover of the characters from He-Man and the Masters of the Universe and Thundercats. Thundercats! It's a super on-the-nose, obvious crossover to do. When you look at sort of the style of those cartoons and the toys, they're both kind of this amalgamation, so to speak, of antiquity and sort of sci-fi. You know, a lot of swords and knife play and adventures across fantastical landscapes. But they also have cars and vehicles and computers and robots and things like that. So they're both very interesting in that way. I guess He-Man kind of dates back farther than Thundercats in terms of the cartoon and the toys. But they both occupy that same niche of 80s action cartoon slash commercials for toys.
Thundercats is the most successful. You can't call it a copy or an imitator of Master of the Universe, but it's definitely the most successful other property in that style.
Right. Yeah, I would say so. And actually, again, I've mentioned this before in the podcast, but of sort of like the big four 80s action cartoons, which are He-Man, G.I. Joe, Thundercats, and Transformers, Thundercats might have the lesser pop culture footprint, but it had a really long run.
Right.
You know, it lasted, like, I think twice as long as He-Man did.
Yeah.
So it's kind of hard to believe and easy to forget that that's the case. But anyway, they did a comic book crossover in 2016-2017. It was six issues. It was just He-Man and Thundercats. And I think I was aware that they did it, but it was there in the comic shop in front of me, and I couldn't help it. I picked it up, and I actually liked it more than I thought. The art style is not my favorite. It's really busy. It's not necessarily... The artist is Freddie Williams II. It's not so much his drawing style. It's more the way that it's colored. It's a very sort of... I don't want to say it's muddy, but it almost looks like a watercolored... It's hard to explain... You can Google image search it.
Yeah.
It's a little strange.
But between the line art and the coloring style, I don't want to say it's hard to look at, but it's very stylized, and it's almost got a roughness to it that you don't see in modern comics.
Right. It almost looks like a sketchy, unfinished drawing, even though it's full of detail.
Yeah.
And if you know the backgrounds and the foregrounds and the settings, you know, the set pieces of the panels are really, really detailed, but it still has this unfinished look. It's a very strange combination of things. And at first, the art style, like I said, didn't appeal to me, but it did grow on me because I liked the story and I liked the book.
Right.
So I think maybe that had an effect on what I thought of the art. But so, yeah, I did enjoy it. I think that did some really creative stuff with the relationships between the characters of these different properties. They did some really good stuff, I thought, with the two main antagonists, Mumra and Skeletor, and to make that work.
Hmm.
And I know you haven't read it, right?
No, I haven't.
I recommend. I should bring it over so you can take a look at it. Okay. Yeah, I did. It was better than I expected. And, of course, just doing this crossover in general is just sort of, you know, 6-year-old me or 10-year-old me, this would have been the most obvious thing in the world to do.
Yeah, yeah.
So it was nice to see it sort of played out.
Right. It's shocking that it, I mean, maybe it existed in a lesser extent in other forms earlier, but I mean, it's kind of shocking it took till 2016 to materialize in
right.
a substantive way.
Because it's not like either one of these properties is a super hot property now that are, that, you know, right. I mean, you know, IPs are tricky things.
Yeah.
But it's not like that some you know lesser company is asking to borrow these big time characters to boost them. I mean, they pretty much occupy a similar pop culture status.
Yeah. Well, you said you have three, and I kind of remembered one that I toyed with putting on my list earlier. And since you have three, I'm going to add a third.
Go for it.
I can't see a discussion of pop culture crossovers without mentioning Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
Oh, interesting. All right. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I see where you're going.
We have talked about this movie once or twice before in the podcast. I say that about a lot of things, but it is always a new angle to take.
They must deserve it.
Yeah, exactly. And surely this is, as I said, it's just the sheer scope of this. I mean, we talked about Marvel and DC being ambitious and then scope. This is on a whole other level because it is the one and only time in history Warner Brothers, Looney Tunes characters, and Disney's cartoon characters have ever shared the screen in any real way. And you know, you mentioned earlier about sort of having to keep things on an equal footing to represent both companies. That was the case in this instance, and it was contractually obligated that neither side's character could have even 1 second longer of a line. They had to be the exact same amount of time.
There were also like Hanna-Barbera characters and stuff like that in the movie. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know like Jerpy Dog runs the elevator and things like that.
Yep,
so.
Tex Avery characters, other classic animation. I don't know if Betty Boop is I guess it's considered a Fleischer character. I don't know who owned the rights at the time, but
right.
you know, those kinds of characters too from the early days of cartoons.
And there's just a ton of stuff in the background in that movie that, you know, probably the people who own those licenses were just happy to get them on screen. Right. Say nothing of trying to make it fair.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So yeah, Roger Rabbit.
All right, so my last one is again, it's really obvious and on the nose, and it's not some obscure thing, but I really, and again, it's I enjoy the comic book versions of this more than the films that have been made. It's Alien and Predator.
Ah, yeah, of course.
You know, once both of these characters existed in pop culture, their crossing paths just seemed inevitable. I mean, it had to happen. It happened early on. The comic books, I think, began maybe in the 80s, definitely the 90s. I have an omnibus edition that has a bunch of Predator Alien stories. And of course, they didn't get around to making any of the movies until the 2000s. And the Alien and Predator crossover movies are not great.
Right.
But I'm not really talking about the movies. I'm just talking about the characters themselves crossing over. It's just a really good, obvious thing to do. And I do enjoy it, despite the fact that maybe it's film presence is not great, but I do like the comics, and I just like the ideas of the characters meeting and existing in the same universe.
Right. Well, I mean, you got to keep in mind too that the first Alien versus Predator movie, though perhaps not amazing or mind-blowing, did do well enough to warrant a sequel.
This is true.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
And also, it's worth noting that at least one of the comic book incarnations of this crossover also included a meeting of Alien, Predator, and Terminator.
Well, there's only one guy missing from that.
And who would that be?
RoboCop.
Naturally. Yeah, missed opportunity there, perhaps, but there's always time. So I guess I've gone through my three picks.
As have I.
Just a quick honorable mention. Less specificity than just the idea itself that I have liked in the past. And that's certain sitcom crossovers.
All right, okay.
Mainly, my favorite among them were the Disney World-centered TGIF episodes, where they would all find themselves having to go to Disney World for some reason. Conveniently, right around the time that Disney bought ABC. Weird.
Isn't that strange? Amazing.
So I looked into that, because it's kind of commonly assumed that that's the reason why this stuff happened, as promotion, shameless self-promotion. But apparently that's not the case. It just made the logistics easier. So you believe whatever you want. It did happen a few times, though, before Disney actually bought ABC, so I guess there was a little bit of a precedent. But it happened on Full House in the 93, I want to say. It happened Family Matters 95. But my specific favorites were in 96, when I believe both Step by Step and Boy Meets World had episodes in Disney World. And I want to say it was the older sister from Step by Step showed up in Boy Meets World as well. Corey was on a hunt to find Topanga. She went there on a science trip that he couldn't go on. And of course, he's so in love that he fucking financed his own flight there.
That's amazing. Him and Sean, got resources.
Yeah, him and Sean just went and were determined to find her. And yeah, so he meets the girl from Step by Step along the way. But so yeah, it was fun. Also, TGIF based, there was a crossover episode with Full House and Family Matters, where Steve Urkel attends a science fair in San Francisco, even though they live in Chicago. And ends up, for whatever reason, ends up at the Tanner household and counseling Stephanie on how to adjust to her new glasses when people are making fun of her that she never wore again.
That's something. Almost like it was a narrative.
Yeah, it was just a convenient plot device.
Device, that's what it was.
So yeah, you know, I like those. And there was one other that I came across in my research that's actually pretty cool. I don't know if it was the final episode or the final season of Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. They end up selling the mansion that they live in, and the show uses that as an opportunity for several different groups of characters from other sitcoms to come through as interested buyers.
Wow, all right.
You had Mr. Drummond and Arnold from Different Strokes come in and look at it. You had the husband and wife from the Jeffersons come in. I think they're the ones that actually end up buying it.
All right.
So they're moving on up yet again.
Wow, I guess so.
But yeah, it was a really cool thing to see them interact with each other.
Yeah, that is kind of neat.
Yeah, nice little slice of TV history. So that's all I got on the past.
Yeah, I don't have a lot of honorable mentions. Like I said, I already kind of listed off a bunch of stuff that has happened. Whether or not I especially liked it, I guess, is kind of beside the point that I was trying to make.
Right.
But yeah, there's been a lot over the years.
Well, I'm a narcissist, so I have to like it. I guess we should move on to things that we would like to see in the future.
Yeah. Now, how many of these do you have?
I have two.
All right.
I could potentially go longer if need be.
I've got three, and then I've got some other just sort of random things that pop into my head as I talk. So
okay,
we can just kind of explore. Let's see. The first one is going to be, I mean, it's obvious to me. It might not be obvious to anybody else in the world, but you know my love for these characters in these movies, so you'll understand it when I go here. I would love to have seen a movie universe combining Buckaroo Banzai and Jack Burton from Big Trouble in Little China.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I never would have considered that, but once you say it, wow. Yeah.
I mean, they both got one movie. I'd have liked to have seen, you know, a third movie there that combined them. Because I think those two characters, they're not very much alike at all. Maybe that'd be part of the fun. Yeah, because both those movies are so off, bonkers beyond anything else, that just combining them, I just think... And the people who made those movies seem so willing to embrace the insanity that those movies both are.
Absolutely.
And the performers, too, that I think, like, almost no matter how crazy the idea of the crossover would be, I think that it would work, and I would have loved to have seen it happen.
Right. Wow. Yeah, that's something that would either be, from an artistic perspective, insanely cool, or would just be so busy and hard to follow that it absolutely might melt your brain.
No, it's absolutely true. It's
or both.
It's a risk.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it's not a risk, but I still would have loved to see an attempt at it.
Yeah, but when you compare those two kind of the styles and tones of both of those movies, yeah, what a natural kind of pairing that would be.
Yeah, yeah. So that's my first one.
Okay. My first one I'm going to go with is something that there is a known connection, but in terms of the actual characters meeting or, you know, being used at the same time, it has never happened. And, well, now it can't happen, but that would be The X-Files and Kolchak the Night Stalker.
Wow, all right. All right. My eyebrows went up at X-Files.
Of course.
And then when Kolchak came out, you lost me a little bit.
Well, Kolchak is known to have been a very big influence on Chris Carter for creating The X-Files.
Right.
It's sort of, I mean, if you watch it, it's clear, there's a clear line to be drawn. It's definitely, I don't know if you can fully say template, but yeah, there's some definite parallels there.
Yeah, I should visit that show because I really haven't seen any of that.
It's very cool. Actually, the whole entire series I think can be had for about $15.
Oh, nice.
On DVD. They used to run it on, I don't know, Get TV or one of those stations that shows old shows.
Right.
And unfortunately, the time slot bounces around. Sometimes it's like 5 a.m. or something stupid. But
yeah,
it's a very interesting show. It's, you know, it's of its time now. But it starred Darren McGavin, most famously known for probably being the father on A Christmas Story.
Okay, yeah.
And later on as Billy Madison's dad.
Oh, right.
He plays Kolchak. He's kind of a, I don't want to say bumbling, but he almost has a sort of like slightly comical, slightly lackadaisical personality. He's kind of I'm not sure if he's a writer or a reporter. But he's using a typewriter a lot. But he covers these paranormal type events that right. nobody else wants to do. And, you know, each episode is a different focus and, you know, the effects are what they are and a lot of it takes place in the dark, but it's you know, it's very intriguing.
Yeah.
So it'd be very cool to see or to have seen you know, Scully and Mulder meet up with Kolchak and kind of have that maybe that conflict from the old style versus the new or the mentor possibly position and then kind of tackle some crazy thing together. And
right.
It would have been really fun.
That sounds like it would have been fun.
Yeah.
That's only it had happened.
Right.
All right. So my turn. So this one, again, like when I'm thinking of these things, they all sound obvious and maybe they do once you say them, but we'll see what you think. So my next one is, it would be a period piece in the 1930s. And it would be a crossover, you know, Indiana Jones on an adventure in Africa comes across the Phantom.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that'd be great.
I love the character of the Phantom. I like the newspaper comic strip. And even though it's cheesy, I like the early 90s movie, The Phantom, with Billy Zane. And in the time frame, the time period matches up, the 30s with Indiana Jones. So.
It's good cheesy, by the way.
It's good cheesy. It's well made. It's well made, but cheesy. Whatever. The point is, I think that would be interesting. I think it would be pretty easy to get them connected.
You know? For sure.
Like I said, Indiana Jones is on some adventure, and right. Oh, you can't take this thing. It's, you know, and that would be the exact story you talk about. Like, there's an initial conflict.
Yeah, yeah.
There's this idol that he wants to get, and for the museum, of course. But the Phantom's like, hey, you can't take that. That belongs to my friends over here.
Right.
And but it turns out there's a bigger baddie to fight and whatever. Yep. So I think it's a really easy sort of, maybe a little bit cookie cutter, but I think you could get there pretty easily.
Man, yeah, that would. Maybe be the most satisfying, if well executed, of any potential film crossover I could imagine. What a great pick.
Why, thank you.
I initially had two, but I decided to pull one out here and save my other one for my big final reveal.
All right.
And hopefully you don't have it on your list.
I don't think so.
One that, I guess this one is similar in that pick that you just had with Indiana Jones and the Phantom, in that it involves kind of a pulp, borderline, possibly public domain character, in that I kind of always thought it would be really cool to see the Three Musketeers meet up with Zorro.
Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of like a lot of swords.
It is a lot of swords.
And a lot of swashbuckling, but can you have enough swords and swashbuckling?
It'd be no less than, what, five swords?
Yeah, if you get D'Artagnan involved, then then you've got five swords. The quintuple blades? I don't know. But yeah, I mean, it might be, I think the Musketeers were based in France, right?
Yes, it's yeah. So because they had the, you know, their swords are the foils.
Right. So obviously I'm guessing the Musketeers take place significantly earlier than Zorro. I think Zorro is around the 1800s in as California is forming, you know, getting breaking off from Mexico and everything.
Right.
But there's a lot of Spanish, you know, royalty or what's the word for somebody who's noble? Spanish nobles coming over.
The nobility.
Yes, from Spain, sent at the behest of the king and queen to make sure everything in California is proceeding as planned. And it wouldn't be too much of a stretch to imagine Don Diego having to go back to Spain and, you know, potentially have business in France.
Right.
I've loved both of those sets of characters at different points in my life, and just to put all of that high adventure and swordsmanship and everything into one orgasmic movie would blow my mind.
Right, absolutely. So before I get to my third and final pick, I'll just read off some ones that I considered. The first one would be, again, obvious to me, which would be a crossover between the movie and characters from Tron and the characters from the cartoon reboot.
Oh, I didn't expect you to say reboot, but it makes perfect sense now.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty obvious, and because it's so obvious and they kind of do the same thing, it might not actually be that good because you're not, there's no sort of collision of culture there. You know, they're all just computer programs.
Yeah. It would be cool to see it executed more in the reboot style. Just go see the Tron characters in full-on CGI.
Right,
where
right.
I feel like they've had to sort of overcome some technological limitations before.
That's true.
And this would just kind of set them free, I think.
Yeah. The other one I had is I'm always kind of fascinated by the sort of one-off superhero and adventure characters from cartoons from the 70s and 80s that are not mainline.
Oh, I know where this is going.
Well, you know I'm going Thundar.
Yep.
So Thundar, of course, with a He-Man crossover or a Thundercats crossover, but not just Thundar. Also, like, you know, the Mighty Mitor and right. Space Ghost and Birdman and the Herculoids.
Yep.
To see them crossover with any number of comparable properties, whether they would be from comics, other cartoons, I just think there's a lot of potential fun there to be had.
Very true.
And there's a lot of different. I always wanted to see Space Ghost and Green Lantern go at it for some reason. Like, I think that's a fun combination, for instance.
Makes sense.
I think there's a lot of good stuff. Thor and Mitor. I mean, they're an obvious analog for one another.
Right.
So I think that there's a lot of fun stuff in there. And then the third idea, sometimes in my head, it's not always about directly crossing over two characters or two stories. It's trying to build like a fan canon that connects one thing to another. You know, like somehow the movie, you know, Blade Runner and Terminator are connected, you know. Somehow the movie Contact and the book Contact with Jodie Foster, you know, they travel these wormholes.
Right.
And somehow, you know, they find the planet Arrakis and they find the spice and that's what leads to Dune, you know. Right. Just trying to create these sort of false connections. So I don't have a lot of specific ones that in that category, but it's just fun for me, like in my head when I'm just sitting quietly, I'll just explore these connections and see if there's anything there.
Yeah, a lot of interesting ideas for sure.
Blade Runner and Terminator, for instance.
Yeah.
Thinks he's just fighting another, oh my God, why am I forgetting the name of them?
Replicant?
Replicant, goddamn, yeah. Instead, it's a Terminator. Anyway, okay, so my official third pick, though, is, I think this is a pretty good one. I think it's going to surprise you, and I think it's pretty good. It is a crossover between Beetlejuice and Hellboy.
Ah, yeah, I would not have considered those, but wow, very interesting.
Now, in the past, I've always kind of made the obvious connections between like Hellboy and Ghost Rider or Hellboy and Spawn.
Right.
But I think that the vibe of Beetlejuice is, you know, a different kind of vibe. It's a goofy, fun vibe. And I actually think that that is a good contrast with the way the Hellboy is as a character.
Right.
And the way a lot of his stories go. I love the Hellboy comics for a couple reasons. One, yeah, I like the character. The character is not super dark and serious all the time, like something out of Spawn.
Right.
He's kind of a smartass.
Yeah, he's got a real dry kind of wit.
Yeah, he does. And I like the comic books because it's like reading Conan the Barbarian almost. It's, well, I could do a lot of crossovers with Conan, too, by the way.
I'm surprised you hadn't.
I wasn't even thinking of that. Thundar and Conan, hello.
There you go.
Anyway, Wherein a lot of the stories in the comic books that you get for Hellboy are just self-contained. Mm-hmm. There are some stories that go on for issue after issue. And then there's a story that you'll read that's just from this random period in his life in 1952 that takes like 3 pages.
Right.
Then there's another one from 1978 that takes 10 pages. And then there's one from 1987 that's 2 issues.
Yeah.
And then there's one from World War II that's 2 pages. You know what I mean? It's like reading all these just short stories from different pieces of his life, parts mm-hmm. of his life. So it's a good comic to read because you don't always get bogged down in the overarching sort of soap opera of his never-ending story.
Right. Yeah.
There are these little like pieces of it. And again, I think that like that's partly why a character like Beetlejuice would fit so well into it, because it wouldn't be like, it would just be like this weird encounter he had with this supernatural force that was very strange and very odd. And while Beetlejuice is doing his over-the-top thing, Hellboy would be coming back with that dry wit, like you said. I think right. there's just a lot of potential there for sure. entertainment and comedy. And again, visually, you get Del Toro, who did the Hellboy movies. You get Tim Burton, who did Beetlejuice. I think there's a lot of commonality there.
Absolutely.
If you did a movie of it. But I think the comics, if you did a comic book version of it too, I think Beetlejuice would transfer to comics really well, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
And definitely. I just think that's a fun idea. That's why I created it. I thought it was pretty good. That's why I'm presenting it as my number one pick.
Yeah, there's virtually endless possibilities with, you know, where you would take both of those characters meeting up.
Oh, yeah.
You know, they all have their little side creatures and their, you know, the monsters of Hellboy meeting the sandworms of Beetlejuice and
absolutely,
whatever.
Absolutely, yeah.
That's its own visual treat.
There's a storyline in Hellboy called, you know, it's the Conqueror Worm.
Mm.
You know, that could be where the crossover comes from, because the Conqueror Worm is this, you know, I mean, that right there is your connecting thread.
Who's listening to this? This is the pitch.
Make it happen.
Yeah, great. Great potential mashup there.
I thought so.
Well, I guess it's time now for my number one. And believe it or not, it also involves Beetlejuice.
Oh, no way.
Beetlejuice meets the Ghostbusters.
Oh, that's absolutely. Absolutely.
Mainly coming from, in my brain, the fact that I have been going real deep down the rabbit hole of buying back past toys. And I just recently bought 4 of the Beetlejuice figures from 1989. And Kenner made those, and Kenner also made the 80s Real Ghostbusters toys, and they're about the same scale and size. And
they both have the same weird features, you know, that
style,
are
style
like,
features.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they're all supernatural based. I mean, it's the, you know, the Ghostbusters versus the ghost with the most. I mean, he's what better antagonist slash potential ally could they have?
Man, that's really good. Yeah, I like that. I might like that better than my Hellboy. God damn it. How dare you?
Yeah. The only way to top it is to kind of match it. But, I mean, both are just endlessly in your brain. You could be entertained endlessly with the possibilities.
That's so good, too. And the interesting thing, see, where my head goes with that is, you know, the Ghostbusters, they deal with all the supernatural stuff, but it's all taking place in their world.
Right.
So in a storyline with Beetlejuice, I see him sort of like bringing them into his world,
right.
you know?
Which is,
and that would be the switch up there. So yeah, that's, like you said, that's endlessly.
And it's something we haven't really seen much of in the Ghostbusters movie before.
No, not really at all.
If you look back at the timeline that the movies had, it almost could have happened in real life. You had Beetlejuice come out the year before Ghostbusters 2. So, you know, maybe Ghostbusters 2 could have potentially been a year or two later and involved Beetlejuice. I mean, obviously, this wasn't even a thought in anybody's brain, but I'm just thinking
right.
of potential, like, this could have happened.
Well, that's part of the fun of this conversation, right. Not because it was actually reasonable in any way.
Yeah, exactly. yeah, I don't know. I just envision a Ghostbusters 2 that is this instead of involving Viggo, the Scourge of Carpathia, even though he's quite an amusing character in his own right.
I actually do. Yeah. In terms of Ghostbusters 2, I mean, not to go off on that tangent, I actually do like that movie.
I do too.
I like the painting. It is creepy. As a kid, it creeped me
out.
Oh, yeah.
It's effective.
Like that painting with the eyes and everything, it was really good. I remember being really scared of the evil goo in the sewer.
Yep.
That scene freaked me out when I was a kid. I know that much.
Well, it's, yeah, they're pulling him up and it's like reaching for his legs. And
yeah, yeah.
As a kid, that's one of the most terrifying things you could imagine, is being pulled into something.
For a half a second, I thought, Okay, so the Ghostbusters do have an interesting crossover. It was basically a Dan Aykroyd cameo.
Yeah.
In the Casper movie.
Oh.
Yeah, they're trying to you know, get rid of the Boo Brothers.
Right.
Because they're trying to sell this mansion or whatever. And so the first character they bring in is this SNL character that's like this priest.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember the name of the guy who plays him. I'd have to look it up.
Yeah.
And, you know, he comes in and he thinks he's going to exorcise the ghost, and he comes back out and his head's turned around backwards.
Right.
And then the next, you know, snippet of this montage is, you know, the yee-hee-hee laughing and explosions and lightning. And then Dan Aykroyd comes running out the door and runs down this porch steps and goes, "Who are you going to call?" "Somebody else." And he runs off.
Perfect. I don't think I've ever actually seen Casper, even though it's a kind of a cult favorite among maybe our age and a little younger.
It's fun and watchable. My kids like it. It is. It's not that bad. It holds up pretty well.
It's October, so that might have to go on the list of potential watches. I just want to acknowledge your point about how you were legitimately creeped out by Ghostbusters 2, and that's sort of like another key reason why Ghostbusters and Beetlejuice would match up so well, because both of those movies, while, you know, very funny and very kind of light in certain areas, or not even necessarily light, but just kind of amusing, are both legitimately, they're both grounded in seriousness, and they're both legitimately scary in parts. And I think that's the kind of the key to both properties.
Mm-hmm.
And to have that match up would just be sublime.
I think that is tricky to get that balance with those two movies. I mean, maybe it has something to do with like the age I was when I first saw them. I don't know. But a lot of other movies have tried it and failed. You know, they end up being, right, you know, too much of one thing or the other. Like I mentioned Casper. It's watchable. It's fun. It's not legitimately scary.
Yeah.
In any kind of way. Even as a kid, I don't think it would be. Same thing for like The Haunted Mansion with Eddie Murphy.
Oh, right.
Again, I know that movie was a huge bomb and failure, but it's a fun movie. Watch it with my kids. It's great. But there's no real part of it that's legitimately scary.
Right.
The one thing that maybe comes close to that, although it's not as much of a kid's movie at all, is Sleepy Hollow with Johnny Depp.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, that's an interesting point you make, because that's not a balance that's been well struck.
No, yeah, it's the world found out in 2016, it is very hard to replicate.
I mean, there's rumors of, you know, the crossover thing is fun, and there's rumors that there's going to be some crossovers coming up in major, you know, movie properties and things like that. There's a rumor that the upcoming Bumblebee movie, which, god damn it, is sucking me into being interested with all of this Generation 1 imagery, you know, old school Soundwave and Shockwave and Optimus Prime.
Definitely.
There's a rumor that they're going to have, you know, G.I. Joe is going to pop into that movie, and that they're going to have some crossover stuff going on. There's rumors that, you know, G.I. Joe or Transformers properties could be making their way into the Marvel Cinematic Universe at some point. So, you know, hopefully the crossovers you want to see and I want to see will happen someday. And if not, we'll get some crossovers that we don't see coming.
Yeah. Let us know what kind of crossovers you want to see. And that's all for now. Until the next time we crossover, I have been your friend Claude.
And I've been just Jamie.
See ya.
Later.
Nerd Bomber Podcast is a Ghost Factory Internet production brought to you by the WHAM Network.